listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As we reported earlier this past week, Russia's President Vladimir Putin made his annual report to Russia's parliament. To discuss some of the particulars of that address, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer at Moscow State University, from Moscow via Skype this past Friday. Mark, welcome back.
Yeah, I don't want to interrupt the U.S. elections, Don. I know how important the next 2 years of primaries is until the next circus comes to town. The elections that never end but never seem to result in anything different somehow.
Yeah, it's funny how that works, isn't it?
But yeah, thanks for having me on, Don. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR with you.
It's our pleasure. So I guess we'll start with Russia's version of the State of the Union address. We had listened to a good set of excerpts from President Putin's address to the Federated Assembly earlier this week, and maybe you could give us your take on that first.
Yeah, so, you know, this is the annual address. It's the president's address to the Federal Assembly, which is both houses of the Russian parliament, if you will, the Duma and the Federal Assembly, the Federation Council, as well as, you know, the High Court and other top government officials and celebrities. It's just like the State of the Union, basically. So this year's address to the Federal Assembly was an hour and a half. And out of that hour and a half, 1 hour and 15 minutes of it was devoted to domestic issues, which Putin made clear, you know, at the beginning of the address, are the priority for the country in the year and coming. And part of that is certainly, due to the drop in Putin's approval rating from perhaps the low 80s, high 70s, low 80s, to where it is today at about 67%, which is due almost exclusively to Putin signing off on the government's increasing of the Russian pension age to something close to what it is already in Western countries, right. Which has not been met well in Russia by, you know, really anyone. It's one of those things that if Russia didn't want to raise the pension age, that I would actually agree with that. But then you have to talk about where you make up the financial shortfall, right, as you have an aging population. These are the same discussions that have taken place at the in Western countries for decades now, as they rose up their pension ages. And if Russia didn't raise its pension age, then it would have to talk economically in entirely different terms, because that of course would mean that a large segment of their population, once they reach certain age, is no longer part of the economy as they are in all Western countries. So right, that would put Russia at a comparative disadvantage. Not that that should be the only concern, of course, but you need to raise tax revenue to support the rising pension demographic, the same graying population phenomenon that all industrialized countries are having as they have fewer children and the populations get older. And that's something that all governments across the world are struggling to do in a world with a free flow of capital and tax havens, right? How do you tax your wealthiest more when they just, to make up for shortfalls in other areas, when they simply move their wealth offshore to these tax havens? And this isn't a problem that exclusively Russia is facing. It's a problem that every country in the world, other than those few tax havens, are facing. So, a good portion of it was of this domestic portion was talking about a number of specific measures that are being implemented to encourage families to have more children. Decreased mortgage rates for families with two or more children. Welfare. It's payments that are made to families that have two or more children. And a number of other measures that are specifically designed to help families with two or more children and enjoy a higher standard of living. Another portion was talking about a number of specific measures that are being focused on healthcare. Russia still has free universal healthcare. It's not quite what it was in the Soviet Union. At least it dropped down in the 90s. Everything that I've heard from people who have been using it recently are talking about actually how surprised and how good it is, preventative care and other things. But certainly it does need an increase in money, if nothing else, for the salaries of the doctors and nurses and for newer. A continual supply of newer equipment and facilities and so on. So he highlighted a number of there. He did briefly address the pension system. He addressed the issue of which he was extremely critical, and you could say even a little cynical, of the environment, specifically on the environment. He was talking about the problem that has been a problem in the Moscow regions that have generated small protests, but of which, of course, the pro-Western liberal opposition tried to latch themselves onto and make into a bigger deal. But it does have a serious concern. It's about landfills that are increasingly filled up with trash, right, that are located close to residential buildings. And this is kind of in the suburban belt, if you want to call it that, outside of Moscow, where this has been a problem. It's something that has certainly, reached, the national ears, even if it is a local problem, because it is the Moscow region. And he was very critical of the government bureaucracy that has allowed residential buildings to be built near landfills as they, started to get bigger, and vice versa.
Right.
And he's basically promised executive action on this. But of course, it's not a problem that can be immediately solved overnight. But he certainly there has been some noise, again, mostly in the Moscow region about this. But he certainly moved to draw it to national attention, and you could say playing the good czar. He's putting the focus on the local officials, who are responsible for creating the situation and should be responsible for alleviating it.
Right.
So he also talked about increased money for particularly school education, particularly kindergartens and primary schools, some more science and research and development funding. A big contrast, as you pointed out to me before, between the tone of the American State of the Union address, in that it's less on the America, fist pumping in the air, clapping rhetoric, right, and a little bit more on specific details. You've raised these issues. We've noticed that you're unhappy with these things. These are the things that we're going to try to improve the situation, and down to if not minutia, then at least indicating, specific policies and direction moving forward in an attempt to create these problems. But this whole first hour and 15 minutes is pretty much devoted to increasing the living standard for Russians, particularly Russians outside of Moscow, St. Petersburg, and the other first-tier cities, which Russians, in general, one of the reasons they support the Putin and his governments so much is that compared to the 1990s, the GDP per capita in the country has increased four times.
That's pretty good.
It started from a very low rate, because you have to understand, of course, how far the economy fell under the U.S.-backed liberal Yeltsin kleptocracy, how far things fell from what they had been before, dropped down, and then were picked back up again by Putin. So this is all, considering that, for the last 4 or 5 years, Russia has been under very increasingly tight layer of U.S. and other European client state sanctions on Russia, and which caused a slight recession for a couple of years, minus 1% or something. It was coupled with the oil price war with Saudi Arabia, which eventually Saudi Arabia blinked on, and they've cooperated in the last 2 years to raise oil prices back up to a level that can support both of their countries' economies. Russia's growth in 2018 was 2.3%, which is above the average for the European Union states. This is despite the effects of U.S. and European sanctions and other economic warfare on the country. So I think it goes a good way to showing that the independence that the Russia government has brought to the finance and the economy, the finance sector and the economy in general. The agricultural sector is still booming as a result, actually, of the sanctions. The attempt to isolate Russia you know, that this is what they called it, has only proven that the West is not the world, and Russia has simply increased trade even more with China and India and the Middle East and Southeast Asia and so on to compensate for that. And another milestone was reached just in the last week, that Russia's currency reserves now, Russia runs a budget surplus, not a deficit, because they have a very tight fiscal control. They don't want to expose the country to the control, the U.S. control from the heights of global finance. So they run a very tight economy. Russia doesn't spend more money than it has. It runs a budget surplus and actually still has substantial currency reserves, both in currency, gold, and other things, although it's moving away from the U.S. dollar. And Russia's debt, not just the government debt, not just the region and local debt, but including all corporate and consumer debt in Russia, total Russian debt, everything, is now lower than Russia's currency reserves.
Wow.
Yeah, that, I mean, wow. Compare that to the U.S., where we're now looking at $22 trillion of just federal debt. And if you include in state, city, local debt, you're already there talking $60 trillion. And then you could talk about, of course, the U.S. Debt society, the consumer society with credit cards and mortgages and car loans and education payments and medical payments and so on. It draws a stark contrast. Of course, the U.S. has the advantage there as long as they can continue the process of quantitative easing, as they call it, printing money. To meet their, you know, their interest payments, their debt, because the U.S. is the global currency. But all of these sanctions and tariffs and everything they're doing against countries from you know, not only Russia and but China and Venezuela and North Korea and Syria and Iran, and threatening sanctions against even their allies, European companies that do business in these countries, these new secondary sanctions and so on, and the war of tariffs around the war being waged not only against China and others, but against U.S. allies, Canada and South Korea. It's all making this ability of the U.S. to continue this process of financial impunity and basically not even believing that its national debt exists, because the world, the dollar is the world's reserve currency, it's weakening, it's eroding that position. And eventually, it maybe not now, maybe not tomorrow, but the process has already begun, where countries are seriously now looking at ways of conducting exchange in each other's currencies, barter systems, and finding payment systems that go around SWIFT and other measures of U.S. controlling global finance. So I think the Russian economy is actually kind of an example in that way. It's a tight ship. And there, you know, some things are not splurged on. But when you take a look at the debt levels in Russia and you talk about it compared to the U.S. or even to other European countries, you know, China or Japan with near 200% debt to GDP ratio, and Germany and the United Kingdom also having, you know, extremely high and I would consider unhealthy debt levels. Russia has no debt. So, I mean, this is all what the first part of Russia's State of the Union was, and the majority part.
In the last 15 minutes. You know, it did not sound like an austerity speech at all. In other words, you know, if you were looking at somebody that tightening their belt, saying we got to get a handle on, you know, our debt load, we got to get a handle on our balance of payments, we got to get a handle on, you know, all these different things. And so consequently, we're going to have to go without this, that, or the other thing. It was not that at all.
No, because that's not the situation at all. Russia has finished the belt tightening. They are in growth, right? You know, the economy is growing. They've reduced military spending in the last year by 20% because they have met the country's military modernization goals. Right, Russia fell far behind in the 90s. They know they're never going to be a global superpower. Right, they don't need aircraft carriers, you know, flying off to nations on the other side of the world, you know, to rain hell and fury and regime change down in other countries. But they built a very capable localized military with limited power projection capability and a high degree of technological advancement on certain specific areas like electronic warfare, air defense, and hypersonic weapons, strategic deterrent, and so on, that it feels it needs for its security and regional security in its own neck of the woods as a great power, but not a superpower. And they built that. So they reduced military spending. That we're saying we're back in growth. We've reduced military spending. National prestige projects of the last few years, the Olympics, the World Cup, they're over. Now we're going to focus more money on living standards. And this is where we're going to direct that money. And this is where you should look that we hope to see results. It's that laid out.
Okay, so then you have the last 15 minutes, which deals with something else.
Yeah, the last 15 minutes. Like, there's a section of the State of the Union address that it deals with foreign policy. And specifically on this, I would have to say what I looked for, there wasn't a lot on the two conflicts that Russia is involved in varying degrees in Syria and Ukraine, right? There wasn't a lot in there on that. Probably because in the last year, the situation hasn't changed dramatically on either of those two situations. But the first thing that talked about that Putin talked about was not the West. It was about Asia. It was about the growing, ever-growing trade and cooperation with China, the growing connections with Southeast Asia, opening relations further with Japan and South Korea, showing where Russia's economic and foreign policy priority are right now. It's with Asia. It's not with the West anymore. And then specifically to highlight that, he turned then back to the West and talked about the situation there. And basically he said, you know, we're not going to keep knocking on a door that has been locked, right? Saying that the impetus for deteriorating relations, Russia feels, was due to the U.S. and the rest of the West. And that at this point, if Russia is done knocking on that locked door, and if the U.S. and the West want to improve relations, good. That's what we would prefer. But the initiative is now your responsibility. Right. We're not going to keep knocking anymore. And if you don't want to improve relations, that's not our preference, but we can do that too. Right. And, you know, and even after the State of the Union address, you went a little further. Do you want another Cuban Missile Crisis? We don't want one, but we can go down that road if you want. And he spent a lot of time then talking specifically about the U.S. withdrawing from the unilaterally withdrawing from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, and Russia then reciprocating, and that treaty with both having withdrawn. There's a six-month period, and in just under 6 months now, the treaty will be completely dead. And he highlighted, he saw that, he says that is a potential threat to our national security, to our strategic deterrent, and we will take specifically reciprocal steps. Specifically, the Pentagon last year, before the U.S. pulled out of the treaty, already allocated $58 million in the defense budget to research the building of new land-based intermediate, short and intermediate range missiles, right? What was banned by the treaty. Not the research and development wasn't banned, but the production and deployment was banned.
Right.
But this is already getting a step up on that. Russia said, fine, we're going to allocate that money. If the U.S. moves to production, we will move to production. If the U.S. deploys, if it somehow convinces European states to once again make the European continent a target between the U.S. and Russia, then if the U.S. deploys missiles, be they conventional or nuclear land-based intermediate-range missiles in Europe, then we will target those missiles and we will target the command and control centers.
Right.
It didn't specify where that would be, whether it's in Europe or the United States, that are responsible for making those decisions. And with the new hypersonic weapons, and he talked about several of them in particular and some other weapons that Russia is developing and seems to have at least a 10-year leg up in the United States on, that the response time of these weapons will be symmetrical. They will be equivalent to anything the U.S. puts there. And this is the thing. The U.S. pulling out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, everyone I think who's serious about this knows that it's not actually about Russia. I think I've said before on other formats that it seems likely Russia and the U.S. have both made complaints about each other violating it. It seems that both countries probably have violated it in small ways that are not an existential threat or, you know, a big strategic threat to each other or to Europe. If you notice, it's not the Europeans that are making the initiative out of this.
Yeah.
And Russia and the U.S. aren't particularly threatened by each other's intermediate range weapons, right? Because that would mean Alaska and Vladivostok. That's
right.
The range,
right.
up to 5,500 kilometers. That's
right.
That's the range of these weapons. It's ICBMs, right? That threaten each other's, and those were never, you know, banned by this, you know, long range missiles, or sea and air wasn't banned by the treaty, so. Both countries are actually probably look more concerned with building conventional land-based missiles. We're talking about land-based Tomahawks, basically, because while sea and air wasn't banned by the treaty, both countries would like to have some more land-based conventional intermediate-range missiles. Why? Because they're the only two countries bound by this treaty. China.
Right.
Israel, Iran, France, the UK, India, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, all of these countries are not bound by this treaty and did. And what the U.S. is really concerned about, it's not this excuse that Russia violated it, so we're pulling out. It's China. And that was made clear by statements in both Trump and Bolton when they announced that the U.S. was pulling out of it. They mentioned China again and again. Why? Because their real concern is that the U.S. Geopolitical thinkers, the top brass, the strategists, they all believe that a U.S.-China showdown on the other side of the Pacific, in the South China Sea, to contain China navally, right, militarily, is inevitable. They believe they will have to fight that in the short to medium term within the next 20 years. And China is now gaining the advantage not only with the size and quality of their navy, but with 95% of some of China's missiles being short and intermediate range, fired from land. And many of these missiles are now carrier killers, right? They can take out U.S. surface
right.
ships, and they're gaining an advantage there. And the U.S., while it has sea and air-launched short-intermediate-range conventional missiles, it would like to have them land-based as well. Basically, the U.S., particularly the U.S. Army, which wants a piece of this military pie as the U.S. moves to confrontation with China in the Pacific, it wants to put land-based missiles in Guam, in Japan, and probably in South Korea as well. That might actually be a little bit more of a threat to Russia.
Right.
But, you know, the concern there primarily is it would be North Korea, I think. And that's what they're looking at. Russia, you know, they Putin made this clear as far back as 2007. Once the U.S. pulled out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty unilaterally, the INF treaty wasn't in Russia's best interest. It probably never was. Soviet generals made that clear, that it was basically a gift to the United States. It was
right.
far more advantageous to them as a maritime power and far more restrictive to the Soviet Union, which is a land-based continental power.
Right.
But that Russia wasn't going to pull out because it didn't want the rest of the Cold War strategic treaty architecture to collapse. That's why it kept as part of the treaty. And it made efforts to address the U.S. concerns. Let's have mutual inspections. You can inspect our missiles that you say are over the range, the allowed range, and we can inspect your anti-ballistic missile MK-41 Aegis Ashore launchers that you've put in Romania and are putting in Poland, because they are also a violation of the treaty. And we want to inspect those to make sure that they can't fire, you know, the missiles prescribed by this treaty, because the launchers were also banned. And the U.S. said, no, we're not interested. That we're not interested in solving it. It's the responsibility is all yours. We're not even going to talk, address the idea that we have violated it as well, or, you know, if at all. And we're not interested in this treaty. And the U.S. has already gave far more seriously indication that it will, that in 2 years, the New START treaty, which limits, is a far more important treaty even than the INF, it limits the amount of missiles and warheads that each side has actively deployed. The U.S. has already indicated, given signals, that it is not interested in renewing that treaty. And that would see the last bit of the old Cold War nuclear treaty architecture.
Yeah, the whole
collapse.
Architecture is kind of doing that. Well, you know, to be mindful of it, of course, the context has changed dramatically from 30 years ago. So we're going to have to stop here because we're out of time. But this might be a good place to pick up next week. I'm taking a look at what has changed and perhaps what people might be looking for going forward. So, Mark, thanks a lot for your time, as always.
Thanks for having me, Don.
We'll speak with you next week. And that was Mark Sloboda, Senior Lecturer in International Affairs at Moscow State University, speaking to us via Skype from Moscow Friday. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. Syria, when a pullout, well, doesn't mean a pullout. Also, Venezuela, how's that regime change going? And the botched story known as Brexit. And much, much more on this edition of Crosstalk. Cross-talking some real news, I'm joined by the one and only Dmitry Babich here in Moscow. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. And in Athens, we cross to Alex Christoforo. He is the director and writer for TheDurant.com. All right, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, Alex, let me go to you in Athens here. We have this pullout down from 2,000 to 200. Now it's 400. What is the narrative here? What is the reasoning behind it? And why should we believe it's the pullout's going to happen at all? Because the narrative has changed so many times since December. Go ahead, in Athens.
Well, we've moved from a withdrawal, Peter, to an occupation. And, you know, let's be clear, this is becoming an occupation. And, of course, they're using the pretext of protecting the Kurds and staying in Syria for those reasons. But what it really is the neocons once again inserting themselves in Trump's foreign policy. And I won't even say inserting. They are leading Trump's foreign policy. Once again, you always have the specter of John Bolton and Mike Pompeo kind of sitting in the background as Trump is announcing one of his major, major campaign promises. He campaigned on getting the U.S. out of all these military entanglements, specifically Syria. In 2013, Trump sent three, four, maybe even five tweets saying, what is Obama doing in Syria? If I was president, I would get out. He announced that he was going to withdraw from 2000. Now we've got to 200 troops are going to stay. and we're going to go to 400. And Peter, the question is, are we going to go in 3 months' time to 1,000 troops?
Yeah.
How long are we going to stay in Syria? Is it going to be 10 years, 20 years? Is this going to be like Afghanistan? Are we looking at a 20-year occupation of the country? So no one really knows at which direction this is going. But one thing's for sure, the neocons are running Trump's foreign policy.
You know, Dima, one of the interesting things the Kurds have brought up all of the time, but logic would dictate, and the entire history of the conflict would dictate, that the Damascus government and the Kurds huddle together and hammer out some kind of agreement, because during the course of this conflict, the Kurds and the Damascus government have really had very few direct conflicts here. So this is a ruse here. It looks like to me, and I like what Alexander Christofori said, this is an occupation in search of a mission, and it may have a lot more to do with pleasing the Israelis and quote-unquote, keeping their eye on the Iranians. And also, and I think it's very, very important here, is to be the ultimate spoiler in ending this conflict that never should have happened in the first place.
Dima. Well, it's absolutely, you're right about almost all of your points. I would say that with the Kurds, the fantastic thing was that when the United States announced that they are pulling out of northeastern Syria and everyone expected the Turks to enter Manbij, then suddenly the Kurdish militia said, no, 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 we would prefer the Syrian government to be there. And this was such a huge blow to the narrative of the Western press, because the narrative in the European Union and the United States was that there is nothing worse than the Assad government. The Kurds are going to be terrified. You know, all the people in Syria are terrified. And then these people invite the Syrian forces to Manbij. But also, I'm just putting myself in the position of someone who reads newspapers in Washington and tries to make sense of it all. What does that person read in the Washington Post? Josh Rogin, Trump steps back from the brink of disaster in Syria. That reminds me, you know, of the Soviet joke. We were standing on the brink of a precipice, but thank God we made a huge step forward, you know. The latest news from the New York Times is that actually they first increased the number of U.S. troops in northeast Syria to 3,000, right? And now Trump is talking about hundreds of states. Hundreds? How many? 20 hundreds? That means the whole contingent would stay?
It's really interesting. Let me go back to Athens. Alex, also this this move, if it's, I don't know how stable it is, this decision, actually gets Erdogan off the hook to resolve the issues in Idlib. So again, this lack of clarity coming out of Washington is a barrier to ending this conflict, because we are in the penultimate moment. And now it looks like we're back to square one in how this conflict is going to end. It's frustrating Russia. It's frustrating Iran. It's frustrating maybe in a positive way for the Turks here. But maybe that's the whole point, isn't it? It's just to churn up this quagmire, keep it going. We know the Trump administration said this before the end of last year. So it looks like this plan of churning and turning this quagmire is actually the real underlining policy. Alex, go ahead in Athens.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've said it over and over, and it's really about occupation. And to me, the most disheartening part of all of this, Peter, is that these are really self-inflicted wounds that Trump is putting onto himself. The Trump administration is putting onto themselves. The conflict in Syria can be resolved very, very quickly if the U.S. would just pull out and they would allow the Kurds to talk to the Syrian government, and that's the key word, what Dimitri said, the Syrian government, the internationally recognized, legitimate Syrian government. These are who the Kurds need to be talking with in order to resolve this conflict once and for all. But the fact that you're keeping 200, and now it's 400, and in 3 months it'll be 1,000, and in 6 months it'll be 5,000, the fact that this is happening is just delaying the process of bringing peace to Syria. That's the bottom line, and it's really also going to hurt Trump in 2020. He needs to realize this. His constituency, his voters, they don't know why the U.S. is in Syria, and they want out of Syria. This is hurting him in the end.
Okay, Dima, Alex just used the phrase self-inflicted wound. Let's revisit the Warsaw Conference, the anti-Iran Warsaw Conference. Would you give a scorecard for our audience, winners, losers? Was anything achieved? Go ahead.
Well, it's just amazing, you know, this conference.
It is amazing.
The Polish press trumpeted that this was a huge success for the Polish diplomacy. You know, the Rzeczpospolita, one of the two biggest Polish newspapers, wrote that basically it's like Madrid in 1991. Well, immediately, a lot of people just laughed at it in Poland, you know, because they noted the difference. In 1991, people were talking about peace in the Middle East, about military forces being kind of, creating a safe zone there. Now we're talking about
war.
War, exactly. about basically containing Iran, which in the American modern language means war, right? We have basically the former New York City Mayor Giuliani, meeting the representatives of this
MEK.
Organization,
the
Mujahideen e Khalq, MEK, which committed a terrorist act. On the, you know, during the conference,
well,
they committed
it was
a terrorist act
the
in
good
Iran.
Graces of the messiah president for the left, Barack Obama,
absolutely,
took them off the terrorist list.
Yes, and you know, these people, whatever their purposes, maybe they are lofty, but the methods that they used are terrible. You know, there were people killed in Iran, and Giuliani, after meeting them, says, let me quote it, "Everyone agrees that Iran is the number one state sponsor of terrorism in the world. That has to tell you something. Iran is a country you can't rely on, do business with. You can't trust it." Okay, so
I think you and I and Alex and our audience knows what country that is, and it's
absolutely
not Iran.
It's
okay?
Not Iran.
Let me go back to Alex in Athens here. Again, a self-inflicted wound here, because the highest officials in the foreign policy elite of the EU boycotted it. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. And also, as we've said previously, when Benjamin Netanyahu got on the plane on his own website page, it was, you know, this is, I'm paraphrasing here, a conclave for war against Iran. Well, I think by the time he landed on the in Warsaw, they had to change that to conflict. Okay, because Arab leaders were there, and they said, "Well, we didn't sign up for that kind of language here." I mean, it looks like the administration is just completely tone deaf. And then this administration, when it comes to Iran, even though it's a continuity of American foreign policy, its allies around the world are not in lockstep. And this is very frustrating for Pompeo, for Pence, and for Bolton. Go ahead, in Athens.
Yeah, this meeting is a complete mystery why it even went on. I mean, no one can really explain the purpose of this meeting and this conference at all. Low-level diplomats were sent to this conference. Meanwhile, you had Pompeo and Pence, the two of the highest officials from the U.S. government, are sitting there with low-level diplomats from the EU and other Arab nations. From the beginning until the end, this conference was a complete disaster. You mentioned the tweet by Netanyahu where he said this about war with Iran. They had to change that nearly an hour or two later. So this was sitting on his website and on Twitter, where he said the goal of this conference was for war with Iran. And then you had Mike Pence giving a speech to everybody there where he reiterated the fact that conflict needs to happen with Iran. He said that Iran cannot be trusted. He urged the European nations to get on board with the United States. The whole thing was a disaster from beginning to end, and I just scratched my head wondering, why did they even put this conference together? It was a PR, a foreign policy disaster, and it is, Peter, as we said, a self-inflicted wound on Trump. The Iran policy is a big blotch on the Trump administration. He has started the Iran policy from the minute he got into office till now, has been one big blunder. He needs to rethink this entire policy with Iran.
You know, Alex, before we let you go here, I mean, again, it flies in the face of his campaign promises of not starting, even though I think technically Iran isn't in the Middle East, but I mean, in the greater Middle East, not to start new wars there. And then we have in the second half of the program, we're going to talk about Venezuela. It seems a betrayal of that trust that he ran on. 20 seconds to you. Go ahead, Alex.
I agree, Peter. It's a betrayal of that trust, and we need to understand this was one of Trump's major campaign points. He was not going to get the U.S. involved in any military interventions, and he was actually going to pull the U.S. out of the Middle East. He needs to keep that promise. Otherwise, in 2020, he is going to be in trouble. He needs to realize
okay,
this.
Okay, let me jump in here. I know you'll be with us in the future to see if he does keep his promise. Here, I want to thank Alex Risifora in Athens for joining us. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, now we're joined in London by Marcus Papadopoulos. He's the editor of Politics First magazine. Marcus, great to have you here. Let's talk first of all about the real war in terms of sanctions, and most importantly right now, the media war against Venezuela coming out of the West, primarily the United States. As we before we start talking, I'd like to point out to our viewers here, the organization Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, our FAIR, has a brilliant article titled Venezuela Coverage Takes Us Back to the Golden Age of Lying About Latin America. And I sent you the link there. I mean, I think it's a brilliant article, and it shows the sham that's being portrayed about Venezuela that is actually inciting not only sanctions and a media war against it, but may ignite actually a military conflict. Go ahead, Marcus in London.
Let me, first of all, Peter, set the scene by saying, historically speaking, that the United States has long had disdain, total disdain, for Latin America. And Washington has instigated countless coups in Latin America. And that is what they are attempting to do today in Venezuela. America has orchestrated the tension on the border between Venezuela and Colombia as a way of giving a pretext to Washington to take military action against Venezuela. And as always, Western mainstream media, or should we just be more precise, corporate media in the United States and in the UK, is peddling those lies. Recently, Peter, the United Nations Rapporteur for Human Rights visited Venezuela. And he traveled quite extensively across Venezuela. He compiled a report, and he said clearly and categorically, there is no humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. There is no food crisis in Venezuela. However, has any media outlet in the United States or Britain picked up on that? No. Has the Guardian newspaper run a front page interview with this man? No, because what he said does not fit with the narrative. Let me also add this as well, Peter. In the 1980s and the 1990s, Venezuela was ruled by numerous right-wing governments.
Exactly.
And during that period of time, there were millions of Venezuelans living in abject poverty. Untold numbers, Peter, died because of starvation and malnutrition. Ever since Chavez came to power and then succeeded by Maduro, millions of Venezuelans have been
pulled up
out of poverty. You don't hear about that on Fox News or CNN or Sky News or Channel 4 News because it doesn't fit
the
narrative.
You know, Dima, I mean, I say to our audience here, take a look at the RT website and Gray Zone. Max Blumenthal has a brilliant video of him in a supermarket in Caracas. Mm. And I don't want to be a spoiler here, but I mean, it just confirms everything we've just heard from Marcos here. Where are we in this coup, Dima? Because I've described the first part, this random Guaido, whoever he is, okay, because he's not, he's obviously a stalking horse for the U.S. and this so-called Lima group, which is obviously directed against Venezuela and the current legitimate government there. But it seems to me the first part of this is the shock and awe. Well, it was a bit shocking, but the awe element has kind of receded here. We've seen also vivid footage on the border of these quote-unquote humanitarian aid. I wonder if that was Elliot Abrams' idea, because he's done it before, and he lied about it, okay? And he was given, unfortunately, a presidential pardon for his crimes that he committed in the 1980s under the Reagan administration. Where are we now in this coup?
Well, first about the coverage. I think there was a brilliant article on FAIR.org by Mark Cook. You know, he just decided to check the reports from the Time magazine, and from other media outlets in the United States that there is no aspirin in Venezuela. You know, people cannot get treated even for a flu, you know. And he just went and bought it, you know. All of these over-the-counter medicines were available, right? So much for the fairness of the media. And as Mark Cook rightly writes in his article, you can see from these numerous stories in the U.S. media that they are written by the people who have never been to Venezuela, you know. They even use the same language, you know. Jonathan Steele, a veteran correspondent for The Guardian, he just counted how many times the adjective drab was used for Venezuela. We heard about the drab life in the Soviet Union, about drab conditions in the socialist Soviet bloc countries. So they just repeat the same narrative. They don't have to go to Venezuela to write
it. But all
it.
These countries are the same if they're considered an enemy.
As for the strategy of the United States, strangely, Mike Pompeo in Warsaw during that infamous conference that we have just described, when he was talking about Iran, he described the strategy for Venezuela. Let me quote him. Things are now much worse for the Iranian people, and we are convinced that will lead to the Iranian people to rise up and change the behavior of the regime. End of quote. So this guy is happy. Yes. He's glad that things are worse for the Iranians, that things are worse for
Venezuelans. But these sanctions against Iran and Venezuela, they're not against the people. Of course they're against the people. Let me go back to Marcus here. Marcus, I think you made a point, and I don't think it can be stressed enough here, is that everyone knows me as a conservative person, okay, and conservative outlook here. But there is no denying that under Chavez, millions and millions of people were pulled out of poverty. And more than that, they were given political agency. Democracy meant something to those people for the first time in their entire existence, for generations in the entire history of the Venezuelan state. So Mike Pompeo and John Bolton and Elliot Abrams think that people are going to revolt against the government that has given them so much, while at the same time not denying some of the hardships that are there today. Go ahead in London.
Well, look, Peter, were mistakes made by Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro? Of course mistakes were made by both of them. You tell me, Peter, a president, a prime minister who doesn't make mistakes. However, the most important legacy from the time of Hugo Chavez is that Venezuela was given back to the Venezuelan people. Dignity was restored to Venezuela. Venezuela's state industries and natural resources were given back to the Venezuelan people. And it is that, first and foremost, that makes people in Washington and London foam at the mouth, including those wretched journalists in inverted commas, who work for corporate media. And I will also add this, Peter, very, very quickly. It's not just the likes of Trump, the Clintons, Obama, Bush, Albright and Bolton, who should be in an international court tried for crimes against humanity. It is the owners and editors of corporate media outlets who should also be joining them in the dock.
Okay, I want to stay with Marcus here because you're turning into my Sherpa to explaining the quagmire. I've used that word a lot in this program these days. Called Brexit. What's going on with Brexit? And what you and I have disagreed on this topic over the years, that's fine. And that's good because debate and difference of opinion are good. But tell me how this is working out or not working out in terms of a democracy deficit. Because I think for me, in my conservative outlook, I'm most concerned with this deficit here. And that's one of my gripes with the EU in general. Go ahead, my friend. Explain what's the latest stage of Brexit.
Well, I think we disagree when it comes to a referendum. We agree in that we don't like the European Union, and I've never liked the European Union. But what I would say, Peter, about the Brexit camp and the Remain camp, both are instinctively anti-Russian, and both are claiming that a referendum or a second referendum would constitute democracy. Democracy is not a referendum. Democracy involves people electing other people to represent them at Parliament. That is democracy.
We agree on that. We agree on that.
Get away. Now, what's happening? Well, Britain is supposed to leave the European Union on the 29th of March. I sincerely hope it happens. But we must, in Britain, we must have a sensible negotiated deal with the European Union, one that is approved by British business, British industry, and also foreign investors. Because, Peter, if the UK loses investors like the Chinese, the Japanese, and the Indians, we will be in serious trouble. However, personalities in the Brexit camp and the Remain camp are dictating events. They don't really care about the economy so much. All they care about is pursuing their own selfish ambitions. Well, so we have people like Chakaramuna, who wants to be leader of the Labour Party. We have Jacob Rees-Mogg, Boris Johnson, who believe they have a God-given right to be the next Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And ordinary people in Britain, the needs of ordinary Britons up and down the UK are being sidelined because of these awful personalities at Westminster.
Well, you're not going to get an argument about the personalities here. Let me give the last few words to Dmitry Babych here. Okay, there was 2 years. Mm. They were given a 2-year period to negotiate this thing here. One has to, I will express my opinion, and I think it'll be the history will judge. But it looks like to me this was an intentional strategy of not having a deal before the Brexit happened itself. It's a form of scaremongering, and it's succeeding here because there are plenty of people that say they want another vote, they want to extend the period of withdrawal. If that's the case, then Theresa May and her conservative backers won. 30 seconds go to you,
well,
my friend.
I think the story is that people are being punished for doing a protest vote. In the United States, people voted for Trump because they wanted an end to the war in Syria and to the war in Ukraine and to the war in Libya. And they've been shown now that this is not going to happen, right? The same story with Brexit. People voted to get out of the European Union. And now the message is from the European Union, it's my way or highway. It's us or chaos.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here. I'm going to agree with Marcus Papadopoulos because we've talked about it so many times. I'm not really sure if people really did know what they were voting for.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the problem here. And there's no single majority in Parliament how to move forward. We'll be talking about this more. Many thanks to my guests in Moscow and in Athens and in London. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RTC. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.